Woke up this morning with a sore throat, cold, and talked in a bad mood, and came over here, talked to a number of people, and I'm in a worse one, so let's be quiet. not really. I got a couple things to say. The papers are due, the term papers. We're going to have a lot of people listening to podcasts, I hope. Term papers are going to be due, they're due on 4:30, I should say, on Thursday. We will give you a grace period until 5 o'clock, okay? I do not recommend turning them into the history department. If you're sick or something and you want to turn them in, I guess I can't stop you. But if you do, make sure you date stamp them. There is a date stamp in the history department office, and you can take advantage of that easily. And the staff there will put them in my box. As far as Brady's concerned, Professor Brady will take questions, I assume, through midnight. November the 17th, and he's off duty, okay? How many of you have talked to Tom Brady? You? You found the answer helpful?
He hasn't responded.
He hasn't responded? When did you send the email?
Yesterday.
All right. I haven't talked to you guys for a while. While Fernando is a big favor, the wars that we've talked about, we've classified in the 18th, the end of the 16th, the Seven Years' War. Should talk to you, Maxwell, after class. How do you classify them?
Violent?
Most wars are. I don't know what one. What if you had to have a heading for them, what kind of wars would they be? Think. No, but there's a almost. Exactly. What are the wars that we've talked about? The wars of Polish succession, wars of Austria, no, wars of, no, wars of Spanish succession, wars of Polish succession, wars of Austrian succession. We're going to talk about a war. Bavarian succession, yes, that's exactly right. They're dynastic succession wars, wars of dynastic succession. Someone can tell me what the vacillations in policy on the part of Charles VI with respect to Spain. I thought that was a little confusing the way I gave it to you before. He starts up, remember, at the end of the War of Spanish Succession. There's a war. Spain starts the war. It attacks Austria. Austria and Spain basically make up. Then what happens? Can you use a review? Yeah, that's part of the peace. But Charles has this on-again, off-again thing with Spain. It starts being on after he defeats Spain. And they make peace. Why does he have this on again, off again thing with Spain? Charles VI. He is a Habsburg. He fights in the he goes to Spain in the War of Spanish Succession. For a while, he's Emperor Charles III. All right, so he signs this alliance with Spain in 1725. He's going to have one of his sons, one of his daughters, marry the son of the king and queen of Spain. Then what turns him off? He gets hung up on this idea that Austria is going to be what?
A great sea power.
A great sea power, exactly. Which lasts how long? 6 months. Then what happens after that? Makes another alliance with Spain. Why? You can look at notes. Basically, yes. What is the document before the pragmatic sanction?
Mutual succession.
The mutual succession. What does that say? It's all important. Who makes it up? Leopold, who dies in 1705. What does it say? Sorry? Yes. Who's his brother? Yeah. Joseph has no. His two daughters. All right. Joseph comes to the throne in 1711. Correct. All right, so Charles, what does Charles, I'm sorry, no. Joseph comes to the throne in 1705. He dies in 1711. All right, Charles decides when he comes, in 1711, when he comes to the throne, what's he do to the mutual succession pact? He rips it up. Why? Now, what are Charles's initial motivations in ripping up the mutual succession pact? His own okay. And who are his children when he rips it up? A son and two daughters. He's got a male heir. What happens to the male heir? What happens in 1724? Another child, a woman. That makes it all the more important for children. Thank you very much. There you go. All important. How that. You can get all this from the podcast, Fernando. I'm sure you know. Go ahead, Alex.
Wait, so Charles comes to the throne after Leopold dies.
No, whoa. We can get this easy. Charles comes to the... No, Leopold dies. And then he is succeeded by Joseph. Leopold dies in 1705. Joseph is on the throne from 1705 to 1711. Charles VI is on the throne from 1711 until 1740. Okay?
When is the mutual succession
pact made? Before Leopold dies in 1705. What succeeds the mutual succession pact? The pragmatic sanction. Very good. What does the pragmatic sanction say? It reverts to... Right. Did you quote that from me? Do I talk like that? All right. First dibs, Charles VI. First on the throne of Austria. What powers, why do the powers of Europe, why do they accept the pragmatic sanction? Or do they? Go ahead.
They accept that with their fingers crossed.
I said that with their fingers, one hand tied behind their back, because they know that they'll deal with it when the situation arises, not before. What power? Think now. What power? Besides Prussia, it's obvious, is in the interest to see the problems resolved as a result of the mutual succession pact. Bavaria, I wouldn't come. Power, okay, I'll buy that. But Bavaria is not a great power. There you go, France. Why France? They're next door neighbors to Bavaria. What do you think of? How would you classify? Okay, well, the rulers we've had. You know, we talked about the rulers after the 30 Years' War. Who are the strong rulers in the Habsburg monarchy, and who are the weak ones after the 30 Years' War? Or how are they? Charles VI, classify, evaluate. Strong, weak, Thibault?
He was generally pretty weak because he didn't have a consistent policy. And also, especially towards the end, the only thing he focused on was how to get his daughter on the throne. So anything else was pretty much secondary.
Not only is he focused on trying to get his daughter on the throne, what does he neglect to do? Teach her anything. Teach the poor woman anything. So consequently, at the age of 22, when Frederick the Great, Frederick's not great yet. I don't know when he becomes great. Some people say never. Just like Catherine II in Russia, they never becomes great. She's just Catherine II. When Frederick II invades Silesia, Maria Theresia is basically without any heirs or any information or knowledge. She has to make things. Everything's at sixes and sevens, so she has the crisis of her life. All right. How many of you have finished the term papers? How many of you are starting them? Welcome to the club. I was once your age as well. But more of the Hegelian model is what we would prefer to say. All right, today we're going to talk about the two wars, the Seven Years' War and the war that results after the Seven Years' War, that results in the first partition of Poland. Prior to that, there is the Seven Years' War, and prior to the Seven Years' War, there is the event known as the Diplomatic Revolution. Diplomatic Revolution, which occurs in 1756. That is, there is. If you look at the history of the 18th century, 19th, there is a word. The diplomat. It means something. It means the reconciliation. It doesn't mean a general term. It means the reconciliation. Of these two eternal enemies, Austria and France. People never thought they would ever be reconciled. The hostility goes back to the time of Maximilian I. Encirclement on the part of France. Austria's worried that the French want to crush the rule inside the Holy Roman Empire. This happens dramatically, almost in a matter of months, which is for that time very, very short. Very short indeed. We're going to talk about the diplomatic revolution. We're going to talk about the Seven Years' War, the result, and then the war. If I have time, a war between Russia and Turkey, a war between Russia and Turkey that breaks out in 1768, results from the war of the Seven Years' War. Basically, breaks out in 1768, ends. It ends in 1774 with the treaty, some of you know, the Treaty of Kuchik-Kanyarchi. Remember that treaty, those 162A for the summer? Okay, you're never going to forget it? Okay, well, you're forgiven if you did not have 162A. If you did or did 100 in the summer. If you did, you're not. All right, we're not going to talk about the Treaty of Kuchik-Kanyarchi too much. All right? Before I do that, I want to step back. We're at the middle of coming to the close of the course. The course is going to end with Napoleon, the criminal, bringing down the Holy Roman Empire. I want to look at the position of Europe and the position of the Holy Roman Empire in the middle of the 18th century. The Holy Roman Empire in the middle of, obviously, it's weakened. Obviously, it's weakened badly. It's weakened, but it still has two very important functions to serve. It serves as a community of symbol, and it serves as a community of justice. A community of symbolism and a community of justice. The symbolism is pomp and circumstance. Pomp and circumstance, seeing the emperor crowned, is an event that makes everybody inside the empire basically feel proud. The ceremony, the pomp that attend the crowning of the Holy Rome, more importantly than that, it's a symbol of justice. The emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, is supposed to protect, for the smaller states from the larger states. Now, that's the function often does not occur. But he's supposed to, that's what he's nominally supposed to do, to protect the smaller states from the rapacious larger states, like Bavaria, Saxony, Prussia, things like that. This results in the from the Holy Roman Empire. Does two things, symbol of justice, symbol of community of symbol, pomp and circumstance. One, protection of the smaller powers from the larger. The Holy Roman Empire obviously has declined. It's declined since the 16th century. Let's have a century, the reason. The century of decline and the reason for it. 16th century, it declines. 17th century, it declines. 18th century, it declines. It declines. It declines in the 16th century because of wars of religion. It declines in the 17th century because of intervention in its affairs. Intervention in its affairs by great powers. Declines in the 7th by intervention in its affairs by great powers. Declines in the 18th century because of the growth within its borders. The growth within its borders of great powers, Prussia principally. And intervention also inside its borders by another great power. In the 17th century, the great powers that intervened were France and Sweden. In the 18th, another power will take the place of Sweden and then some. The other power, the Colossus of the North, Russia, comes out of the 7 years war stronger than ever. Stronger than ever. Why also does the Holy Roman Empire decline? Money! The states on its border, its western border, I think I've said this, want to imitate France. They want to imitate Versailles. The petty princes want to imitate, and they want to have a lot of mistresses. Mistresses cost money. Someone has made a study. The smaller the state, the more the duke had, the more mistresses the duke had. I guess that was a way of showing stature or something like that, but it cost money. And many of the states literally go bankrupt. Literally go bankrupt. So that's why it declines. They have written in the 16th century wars of religion. 17th century intervention from the outside, intervention on the part of Sweden and Russia, Sweden and France, intervention in the 18th century, the growth of great power, Prussia, Austria, and the rivalry between Austria and Russia, of course, and the intervention in the 18th century of a new power, Russia, going along with France, going along with France. Okay, now I also want to stop. Look at the position of Austria and the position of Prussia in the middle of the 18th century and the personalities that were in positions of power both. Austria, there is a ruler in Austria in 1750. Her name is Maria Theresia. 1750, Maria Theresia. She's been on the throne since 1740. On the throne since 1740. She'll be on the throne until 1780. Let's get these lines of succession out of the way first. On the throne since until 1780. She's got a husband. His name is Francis Stephen of Lorraine. Francis Stephen of Lorraine will be Holy Roman Emperor from 1745 until 1765. 1745 until 1765. Maria Theresia has a son. Her son will become Holy Roman Emperor from 1765 until 1790. Her son, Joseph II, will become co-regent of the monarchy from 1765 until 1780. When his mother dies, he will become Holy Roman Emperor himself. What is it? And going on, a little bit more about the Holy Roman Emperor. The unique thing between 1740 and 1742, there is no Holy Roman Emperor. Charles dies, and there's a war that breaks out over Austrian succession. In 1742, the French succeed in placing on the throne of the Holy Roman Emperor a Bavarian. Bavarian, 1742. His name is Charles VII. He rules until 1745, and then Francis Stephen becomes Holy Roman Emperor. 1745 to 1765. Then he dies in 17. Joseph, Holy Roman, 1765 to 1790. In the meantime, Joseph is co-regent of the realm. 1765 to 1780, when his mother dies. Is that nice enough? All those dates, when they make nice things on a midterm, on a final. Wouldn't it be nice to ask on a final name? On the name, the rulers of the Holy Roman Emperor in succession, the dates they serve. 50% will get you an A. I think Brady could do that probably without much. I tried last night. I got as far as Maximilian and I gave up, actually. But I was talking about personality, 1750, Maria Theresia. What's this woman like? One, she's very sharp. She has a good sense of humor. She's a keen judge of character. And the woman is a devout Catholic. She is a devout Catholic and a loving wife. That's shown by the fact she and her husband have 16 children, of whom the most famous is Marie Antoinette, who gets her head cut off in the French Revolution. The shock of the defining experience of her life, the defining experience of the life of Maria Theresia was what occurred in 1740 when Frederick the Great stole Silesia. Maria Theresia does not view that as an act of war. She views that as robbery. She views that as a crime. She views that as theft that must be avenged. She loses the War of Austrian Succession. The Peace of Dresden signed on Christmas Eve 1745. They give it to Frederick in perpetuity. Because they've got a lot of work to do at home. The Austrians have no intention of keeping that promise. Well, anyway, the War of Austrian Succession shakes Maria Theresia. Maria Theresia makes three fundamental reforms after the War of Austrian Succession. One concerns the military. One concerns the financial arrangements. And the third concerns state administration, military, finances, and state administration, for want of a better word, though I can remember. Military, she makes people who've served, all those who've served in the army for 20 years or longer are automatically ennobled. All those who served in the Austrian 20 years automatically ennobled. She finds a military academy in Vienna. Three, the third thing she does is she doubles the amount of money spent on finding recruits, finds a military academy in Vienna, and makes anyone who served in the army 20 years or more automatically ennobled. If you're a commoner, to make any difference. Finances. She gets the money to recruit because she the financial system of the monarchy is revolution, is changed. Nobles who escape taxes now pay. Bigger nobles who pay taxes now pay more. She tries to find a state bank. That does not work out. The question is that more money comes into the market as a result of these taxes that Maria Theresia imposed. And the state administration, remember, Charles VI. And remember all those infernal councils that he had. One of them to deal with Austria. One of them to deal with Bohemia. One of them to deal with Hungary. One of them to deal with Italy. One of them to deal with the Spanish Netherlands. She abolishes all that stuff. It's crap, she says. Get rid of it. There's a German word that she would be better. But she gets rid of it. She divides the monarchy into two parts, the Western and the East, in a council responsible to herself. in a council responsible to herself. And the third, another thing, she appoints very able ministers. Very able ministers. One of whom is named Anton von Kaunitz. He of the diplomatic revolution of 1756. Maria Theresia dies in 17. She's a revered figure in Austria. You go anywhere in Vienna, you see Maria Theresia rooms. Schoenbrunn, all sorts of pictures of Maria Theresia and her husband. Usually Maria Theresia, always the Maria Theresia is higher than her husband because her husband was not an original Habsburg. In any case, she is succeeded in 1780 by her son. Her son Joseph II, and this is as good a place as any to pause and to say that this time in the 18th century is generally known in European history as the age of enlightenment, the Aufklärung in German. Enlightenment in English, I mean, when a number of principles come into effect. Reason is supposed to govern human affairs. Reason is supposed to govern human affairs. All sorts of restrictions on monarchy are supposed to apply. The main thing about them, we will not go into all any principles really about the Enlightenment, except to say this one thing. One principle of the Enlightenment, basically, is skepticism toward the church. Skepticism toward religion. That's maybe an overstatement, but we'll use it in this course. Skepticism. Well, Joseph II, the son of the devout Catholic, Maria Theresia, personifies that skepticism to a T. Joseph II, basically, some people call him an agnostic. He's like Maximilian. He institutes a series of reforms, Joseph II. Does. All of them involve in some way diminishing the power of the Catholic Church. Diminishing the power of the authority of the Catholic Church. Monasteries, seminaries, and churches are affected by Joseph's reform. Churches must be within one hour walking distance of a village. Monasteries for contemplation, contemplative monasteries, as Joseph calls it. Monasteries are abolished. Monasteries to care for the sick can exist. Monasteries to care for the sick can exist and thrive and do. And seminaries that are under the control of Rome are gone. Any priest wanting to become a priest must study in a seminary controlled by the church, controlled by the state, controlled by Vienna, under Joseph II's thumb. Under Joseph II's thumb. On the 13th of October, 1781, Joseph II issues a monumental document called an edict of toleration. One other thing Joseph does, he abolishes the death penalty. The edict of toleration doesn't do that. The edict of toleration promulgated by Joseph in 1781 does three basic things. Number one, all for freedom. Freedom of religion is a given for everyone in the Habsburg monarchy. Toleration of all religion, now a given. In the Habsburg monarch. Two, not only that, there's toleration, special status given to the Jews. Special status given to the Jews. Toleration for all people. Religions in the Habsburg monarchy. Special status given to the Jews. And I knew I would forget this. Special status given to the Jews. Sorry, gotta look it up. Oh, non-Catholics have the right to convert. Conversion carries no penalty. I'll go over these again. Sorry about that. Conversion carries no penalty. Special status for the Jews. Freedom, religion, for all confessions in the monarchy. 1789, he goes further. He wants to abolish distinctions between nobles and non-nobles. 1790, even further, he wants to transform the city, the seigneur, the nobility system of Hungary. The last two, transforming Hungary and abolishing the distinction between the nobility, don't work out. There's too much opposition to Joseph's reforms on the part of the Roman Catholic Church, but this edict of toleration. Confessions, no penalty for confession. And there are 70,000 people that convert during Joseph's time from Catholicism to Protestant. 70,000. Freedom for all religions in the Holy Roman Empire. And special status to the Jews. Yes, sir. They were protected by law. They did not, for some reason, consider Judaism a religion. I mean, it was a special status. But they were given protection by law. Freedom from harassment, things like that. All right, so Joseph, in the last two of his reforms, you have a question for now?
Could you repeat the church point? I thought there can't be a church.
Okay, the church, sure. The church, I'll go over all of them. The church cannot be within, a church cannot be built within an hour, of a village. In other words, people in a village can walk to church in an hour, be able to walk. Seminaries. The seminaries are controlled by the state. The seminaries are controlled by the state. Monasteries. There we go. Monasteries are okay if they cure the sick. If you go into a monastery to study, that's bad. That's gone. Joseph comes as far as I need to realize the ideals of the Enlightenment. The most radical basic monarch in the 18th century, except this. All these monarchs, remember, Paul Schrader makes this point, and I read last night. All these monarchs, for all the power that they try, for all the reforms they do, all these are done for one purpose. Basically, to maximize in one way or another the power of the state. Maximize the power of the state. Doesn't have to be through divine right monarchy. It can be through other ways. Joseph comes furthest, probably furthest of all, in this age of the Enlightenment. Age of enlightened despotism. Joseph dies in 1790, and there's a reaction against his reform, a very serious reaction that is going to test the nerves of his successor, a great emperor. He only rules for 2 years. His name is Leopold II, 1790 to 1792. But now we're getting to the French Revolution, getting into things that we should be talking about next week. So we'll stop there and talk about Prussia. What is Prussia? How does Prussia look to observers in the middle of the 18th century? Conquered Silesia, conquered under Frederick II. Prussia still looks, in 1750, very weak indeed. What weak? Especially when compared with their arch rival now, Austria. Weak demographically. Austria's got three times as many people. But more than that, weak from a different set. No, the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs have a mission to fulfill. They look back on the mission they had. The mission they once had to fulfill. They look back on the history, tradition they once had. Tradition. The Prussians can do no such thing. No such thing at all. They had no mission to fulfill. No history, basically, to look back on. Vienna was a world-class city in Roman times. When Vienna was a world-class city, what was Berlin? A fishing village on the Spree River. What makes Prussia rise to the position of a great power? person at the bottom of all human experience, there lies the mystery of the personality. It's just one quote about personality that I found and thought I would throw it out again. You haven't heard that one before yet. You'll hear it again. Personality, kings, or rulers, a succession of great rulers. Let's just go over them. One, the great elector, 1640 to 1680. What did he do? He got Pomerania, most of it anyway. His son, Frederick I, who ruled from 1713. What did he do? Not a lot. But he became king in Prussia in 1701. Much more important were his two successors, Frederick William I. Frederick was 1730 to 17. What do? We know what he did. The canton system. He abolished the bargain that his grandfather had made with the nobility. He establishes an army, and he leaves the state with credit, 2.7 million talents. But he does something domestically too. He builds roads, he drains swamps, he improves housing. Frederick William I, we touched on him, with not time to go back on all on the military genius that he's done. By the time he dies in 1780, Prussia has 80,000 soldiers. He didn't want to use those soldiers, remember, abroad. Wanted them to just be safe. His son comes to the throne in 1740. His son is named Frederick II. His son will rule from 1740 until 1786. Frederick II, also known as Frederick the Great. What is Frederick like? Frederick, as I said before, the old man thinks he's a bit of a sissy. He's effeminate. Frederick is an optimist. He has a sense of humor. An optimist with a sense of humor most of the time. He also is immersed and absolutely loves things that are French. He speaks the French language fluently. At court in Berlin, French is spoken, if you can believe this, rather than German. He writes 40 books, more something like that, during his lifetime. All of them are in French. Histoire de la guerre des sept ans, the history of the 7 Years' War, is the main one. He loves French. Frederick II resembles Joseph in this respect. He rejects the idea of divine right monarchy. For Frederick, the power inheres to the monarch through the state. The state is the powerful thing. Let's look at Frederick's view of the state. One, Frederick's view of the economy and bureaucracy. Two, Frederick's view of the law. Three, and Frederick's view of the army. Four, and Frederick's view, I've got to get this in, of architecture, so I can talk about Sanssouci. Five, architecture, what he does for Prussian culture. View of society. Like his father, the nobles are on top. They furnish all of the officer corps in the Prussian army. They are showered by his father. They're absolutely pampered by Frederick II. He views the nobles and the Junkers, the backbone of Prussian society. Why does he do that? He thinks the Junkers have a concept of honor, a concept of valor, a concept of tradition that appeals to him. Frederick, under Frederick, in Frederick's view, the middle class has a role in society to play. But the middle class has no role in the army. With the middle class, the middle class is to make goods, manufacture goods for use by the army. Is that serious?
Yeah, it was like a huge crowd.
I think they're just walking past. Shall we go on? Okay. I want to talk about Frederick the Great. Yes, Matthew. They may not have a role in the army, but they had a very important role in society. And so for Frederick the Great, society was the army, and they make goods, they manufacture goods for the army, almost all of them.
So was he ever concerned about
Yes, I'll go about that in a minute, because a lot, especially if they're foreigners, they're not foreigners, if they're Prussian, he's very concerned. All right, so he's viewed as a view as he an absolute the noble under Frederick II. Frederick the Nobles become the pillar, the backbone of Prussian society. Many German historians resent the Junker class is becoming ossified, resentful, autocratic under Frederick the Great, Frederick II. And what is his view? Of the economy, bureaucracy? He makes Prussia, and this is where the middle class comes in, the Prussian bureaucracy, the finest in Europe. What do? They collect taxes. Which is needed to fund war. Taxes to fund war. They also do something else. The bureaucracy is used to build roads. Give the state more money. That's one with the idea of the bureaucracy under Frederick William, Frederick the Great, becomes the finest in Europe. They're tax collectors first, last, and always. And the taxes are used to further the power of the state, to build roads, yes, houses, yes, all of which are for purposes of war. What is his view of the law? In 1794, a book is published called The Prussian Code, Allgemeine Landrechte. The idea that a code of law. A general codification of all the laws of Prussia. All the laws published in 1794. The king dies in 1786. That's right, it's published. It's published posthumously. What does it say? It talks about not rights, but duties. The sovereign does not have a right. The first duty of the sovereign is to tax. The first duty of the citizen is to obey the law. Obey the law, pay taxes, and, if they're peasants, serve in the army. Obey the law, pay taxes, and serve in the army. That's not all. The magnificent thing about this document is that it gets rid of all sorts of redundant, obsolete laws. It abolishes torture. It takes a prophylactic view of crime the idea of justice should be to prevent crime, not to deter crime. More than exacting vengeance for crime. Preventing crime more than exacting vengeance for crime. Published in 1794, the Prussian Code. Prussian Code of Frederick the Great. Its idea was just everybody's got rights. It's the right of the king. The duty of the king to tax. The duty of the citizens to obey the law, to pay taxes, to serve in the army if they're peasants, and to obey and to become good citizens. Not only that, they do away, does away with tolerate, does it with as toleration.
Torture.
Does away with torture. codifies and gets rid of all these laws that have been on the books that mean nothing. Takes a view of crime that is enlightened. That is, the whole purpose of this is justice is to deter crime. Deter, not to punish crime, but to see that it doesn't happen. To see that it doesn't happen. So that's Frederick's view of the law. What's his view of war? What does he not? It's not Napoleon's view of war. That's one thing. Napoleon's view of war is this. Napoleon's view of war is that, one, there should be concentration of troops. Concentration of troops. The troops should fall on the center of the opposing army. The troops should fall on the center of the troops should destroy the army that they oppose. They should destroy the army that they oppose. They should fall. They should fall on the center of the army. And they should do so in deep columns. Deep columns fall in the center of the army. Destroy the army that they oppose. But Napoleon has two things that Frederick does not have. He's got money, lots of it, because he gets them living off the land, and all of Napoleon's armies are composed of Frenchmen. Not so the Prussian army. Someone calculates that in 1763, a third of the Prussian army is foreigners. One third, and many of them are raise problems of desertion. Frederick is constantly concerned with desertion and foreigners. Why? For three reasons. Desertion and foreigners make it impossible to get good intelligence. Impossible to get good intelligence. You can't send a scouts out to get good intelligence. They're going to run away. Impossible to get good intelligence. Impossible to maneuver quickly. They slow down marching. Because for foreigners to come into the army, you often got to have their families come with them, and they sleep in tents and they're marching along. Families. Wives. And they have an effect on morale. They're not all homogeneous. They're all different. Morale, walking, marching, intelligence. Three things that Frederick is concerned about. What are his principles of war, unlike Napoleon, because Napoleon's got a lot more. One, surprise the enemy. Outflank the enemy. Outlive the enemy. Outlast the enemy. Outlast the enemy. And live off the enemy's land. Outflank, outlive, outlast. Live off the enemy's land. Surprise if possible. Surprise if those are his principles of war. What are Frederick's achievements? Under Frederick the Great, the Prussian infantry rises to the highest level in Europe. Under Frederick, the Prussian infantry rises to the highest level in the guns they use. They're flintlocks. Flintlock guns, the paper that is, they use paper cartridges, paper that can be fired very rapidly. Paper cartridges that can be fired very rapidly. They're not like pikes that the Germans used to use. They're guns with paper cartridges. What else does he do? He revolutionizes the concept of linear formation. Linear formation. Troops fight. Used to fight in groups, in lines of six. Frederick cuts that down to lines of three. That makes it easier for troops to fire quickly at the enemy. The army's style of war. How does the army advance? The army advances in aligned ranks. The army advances in a line with officers at their side, to the beat of drums, with Prussian peasant soldiers singing Lutheran hymns. A mighty fortress is our God, though not the way you saw it here, the improvised version of the 21st century, the jazzed up version that your instructors selected. They were a little less sophisticated, Anyway, they sing the mighty Lutheran hymn, or God is our Father. Okay, so what else does Frederick do? Frederick's a military genius. A political genius. And also a cultural genius. Under not like Martin Luther, but Frederick perfects the French language and speaks it better than any Frenchman, better than any educated French. He builds a palace 50 miles from Berlin, a palace in Potsdam, a palace called Sans Souci, which is French for without care, without worry. It's where he goes to get away from a wife he can't stand, and a father-in-law he can stand even less. Goes there all the time. The style of Sans Souci, there are four palaces and a garden. The style is light. The style is, it is a Rococo style, not Baroque. Light style. He goes there to relax. And to Sans Souci, Frederick invites the enlightened thinkers from France, Voltaire, Diderot. He loves to talk philosophy. Okay. That's Frederick, his view of the state, bureaucracy, the economy, view of the law, the way the Prussian army operates under Frederick the Great. Okay, we're looking now at Frederick the Great. We're looking at Frederick the Great in the middle of the 18th century. Frederick the Great ends the War of Austrian Succession in a state, he believes, of isolation. He believes also that the French are bent on expanding in Europe. The Prussians have no choice but to ally themselves again with the French. Though on terms different from those that existed in the War of Austrian Succession. I'll tell you what that is right now. What were those terms? The French in the War of Austrian Succession didn't march to Vienna like Frederick wanted. They marched on Munich. Doesn't want that. Unfortunately for French, he dismisses as absolute fantasy. Before that, he said, I can show the French. I can show them that there's more than one fish in the sea. One fish in the sea. Fish in the sea, there's Britain. Frederick thinks that, the consent, and the possibility that Austria could ever align with France, out of the question. Unfortunately for Frederick, there appears in 1753, the Chancellor of the Austrian Empire, appointed by Maria Theresa, William Anton von Kaunitz. Kaunitz comes to office in 1743. Kaunitz will stay in office for nearly 40 years. Kaunitz is a diplomatic genius, on par with Bismarck. Kaunitz looks at the situation, and he sees he does not like the diplomatic situation, and he does not like where Austria finds herself at all. Austria is committed to the alliance, an alliance with England, an alliance with the United Provinces. Austria's aim, Kaunitz's aim, Maria Theresia's aim, Joseph's aim is to get back Silesia. The Austrian Netherlands are far away. England is a sea power. Kaunitz thinks, wouldn't it be wonderful if we said the unsayable, actually we thought the unthinkable, and said the unsayable, he approaches France. He said, look, we've got Austria, we've got the Netherlands, we've got territory in Italy. The French say, no way, we are allies of Prussia. We had been. More than that, you guys are enemies of the Turks. We're allies of the Turks. We'll work. Kaunitz goes back. Frederick, secure, supposedly. But events are stood on their head by developments in North America. In North America, there breaks out what is known in American history as the French and Indian War in the middle of the 1700s. Like this, the French have conquered most of Canada. The French have conquered Louisiana. When I say Louisiana, don't think the state of Louisiana. Think all the way up maybe to South Dakota or Nebraska. And they begin to build forts between Louisiana and Canada to connect the two for strategic reasons. This upsets the people, the colonists on the Atlantic seaboard. And the British declare war on France in 1756. In 1756, this changes the diplomatic picture of Europe. The English come back to the Austrians and they say, in the event of war in Europe, we expect you to deter France. You to deter, well, we take care of France. We take care of France in North America. Kaunitz says, look. Okay. You want that? You can have it. But you must first do something that you must bless. You must be a participant in an alliance we have just made, an alliance with Russia. The alliance is with the Empress Elizabeth. Elizabeth comes to the throne in 1741. She's going to die, remember this, in 1762. Elizabeth hates Frederick the Great as much as Maria Theresia does, if such a thing is possible. Because Frederick the Great in the Austrian War of Austrian Succession caused Russia to be invaded by Sweden. The invasion was repelled. But Maria never forgets it. So Kaunitz says, you've got to bless this Russian alliance. Well, that's no big deal for the British. No big deal at all. Half the British Russian exports go to Russia. Half the British exports, Russian exports, go to Great Britain. Great Britain sends the British naval goods for the, and make fully half of the Russian Navy has English officers and English sailors. The British are only too happy. They sign in 1755 a convention with the Russians. Elizabeth promises to put 50,000 men next to Prussia to prevent Frederick the Great from falling on Hanover. That's where the monarch of Britain is from. Prevent Frederick the Great from overrunning Hanover. Frederick hears about this convention, and Frederick is panicked. He is alarmed. He faces war on two fronts. Austria, the United Province, the Netherlands, on one's armed with England, and now Russia in Hanover. He's going to be squeezed to death. Two, he is still pissed at the French for the way they ran the war. They didn't march on Vienna, they marched on Munich. Frederick goes to the British and says, hey, you know, you're paying the Russians to occupy Hanover, giving them subsidies. You can give me half. The British say that's not a bad deal. We need our money for war in North America. In January 1756, Frederick makes the worst blunder of his career. He signs the Convention of Westminster with the British. He agrees to protect Hanover, not the Russians. And the French are absolutely furious at what he's done. He's allied himself with the enemy in North America. He's allied himself, and two, he does so, he says, because he wants to show the French, There's more than one fish in the sea. Who is this little upstart? We've got how many? 20 million people. Prussia has what? 5, 6. Who is he to dictate French policy? And with Great Britain, this gives Anton von Kaunitz his chance. He offers to place 23,000 men on the Rhine against France. And in the spring of 1756, the diplomatic revolution occurs. France and Austria for 400 years, enemies sign a treaty. But the diplomatic revolution is only half complete. The French still cannot believe what the Prussians have done. They say to Kaunitz, Kaunitz, the alliance is a defensive alliance. The alliance is a it will not operate unless Prussia is the aggressor. I should have made this clear. It is the aim of Kaunitz. It is the aim of Maria Theresia. It is the aim of Empress Elizabeth, not just to get back Silesia, but to wipe Prussia off the map. The Russians and the Austrians have concluded the alliance against Frederick. The Russians are anxious to move against Frederick at once and crush Prussia forever. The Austrians tell the Russians, we need more time to get our troops together. War is going to break out. For certain we're going to crush Prussia, but it's got to be postponed for 6 months. Frederick has good intelligence in Petersburg. He hears that. He hears that there's a plot against him. He feels encircled. What does he do? In the fall of 1756, he invades Saxony. What are the implications? Saxony is a neutral state. 2, Prussia becomes the aggressor. 3, Frederick is so concerned to show that there's a conspiracy against him that in Dresden, the capital of Saxony, he opens the archives. And 4, I guess this connects with 2, Saxony's a neutral state. Prussia is the aggressor. Now the clause in the Franco-Austrian alliance for an offensive operation kicks in, begins to operate. The French declare war on Prussia. And the diplomatic revolution is complete. Complete. Of what? Sure. Good. 1, it's a neutral state. 2, Prussia is it makes Prussia the aggressor. Saxony was a threat to no one. 3, he opens the archives. I probably said these in a bad order. 4, because he's the aggressor, it fulfills the French condition. They said to the Austrians, we won't operate this alliance unless Prussia acts first. Unless Prussia takes up arms first. Well, she did. She marches into Saxony, and that is all Kaunitz needs. That is all he needs. France declares war on Prussia. And Frederick is in a war, the war of his life. Who are his allies? The British. Where are the British? They're fighting in North America. Who's in this coalition against him? Well, Austria, Russia, for one. Spain, for another. Sweden joins again. Frederick fights in the Seven Years' War. 5 million people, I think I said this before, 5 million people against countries with a population of 100 million. Of 100 million! And the war is disastrous. 1756 to 1759. Frederick wins several good battles. Wins a great battle at Rossbach in November of 1757. Before that, however, forgot, his brother has to be fired from command. His mother dies, to whom he's very attached. He makes this one victory at Rossbach in 1757. Whom does he defeat? Forces of the Holy Roman Empire that are armed against him for what he's done. One state of the Holy Roman Empire defeating another state. Nothing new. And this is, the Germans would say, this is the first German defeat of France ever. Even though the army is not all German. It's led by the King of Prussia. It defeats France at the Battle of Rossbach. But still, the clouds lower on the horizon. The army is short of supplies. The army is short of supplies. Frederickson has a nightmare. His nightmare is for the this. He does not want what he wants. He wants to do everything he can to prevent the Russians and the Austrians from hooking up, from joining each other, if you will. That's why, I should have said this, what's why, we'll go back. Why does he invade Saxony? Because, one, he feels encircled. One, two, Saxony lies logistically right in the path to Austria. It prevents Austria and Russia from lining up, linking up together. 1759, 1760, 1761. Frederick wins some significant victories, but still the overall trend is dreadful. In 1762, the unthinkable, his nightmare occurs. Austrian troops join the Russians. In 1762, in an event that will not be repeated until 1945, Russian troops occupy Berlin. The war is over. Frederick writes in his diary, I hope I'm killed. I hope I'm committing, I feel like committing suicide. Russian troops in Berlin. The war is over. Or is it? I gave you the dates of the life of the Empress of Russia, Elizabeth I. Elizabeth dies in 1762, hating Frederick. She is succeeded by her nephew, an imbecile, a drunk. His name is Peter III. Peter has a fondness for things military, has a fascination with Frederick the Great. Fascinated by Frederick the Great. Has masturbation fantasies about Frederick the Great. Oh, take my word for it. It's well documented. Are the instructors allowed some poetic license? Cut me some slack. He admires Frederick the Great. Anyway, what does he do? He pulls Russian troops out of Berlin. Miracle of miracles. The war is saved. That gives Frederick what he needs. Frederick defeats the French. Defeats the French in the year 1763. In the year 1763, the Seven Years' War ends. The Seven Years' War ends in 1763. What are the conditions that end, which the Seven Years' War ends? One, Britain. Britain has decisively defeats France in North America and on the sea. Britain decisively defeats France in North America and on the sea. Till Austria and even though Frederick has saved his life, his life is saved by Peter. His life is saved by Peter. Frederick's Prussia is at the point of exhaustion. At the point of exhaustion. And so is all. They fight to a standstill. Well, here we have one of these classical balance of power situations. An imbalance of power. Prussia and Austria have fought to a standstill. They want war. France has been decisively defeated by Great Britain. France wants to get back at Great Britain. War is going to break out. And war does in the year 1768. The overriding conclusion of the Seven Years' War is the power of Russia. Now, there's a crisis in Poland as a result of the Seven Years' War. The crisis stems from three things. One, the weakness of Poland. Two, the strength of Russia. Three, the personality of the new Tsarina, Catherine II. Poland is weak. How is she weak? She's weak institutionally. She's weak socially. She's weak politically. She's weak economically. She's weak militarily. Weak militarily, why? Most of the fighting occurs in the Seven Years' War on Polish soil. Weak socially, Poland is composed of noble families. Weak institutionally, one Polish senator can prevent a law from being passed. And we'll stop there and pick it up. The war ends in 1774, the beginning of the next year.